This House Senate bi-committee work group will be called to order. We're kind of leaving off or starting up where we left off. We didn't finish the agenda last week, and so we're going to try to get the things done that we didn't get done at our last meeting. And I believe that we were going to hear from the Department of Corrections. No? I guess we have taken some of the items that we had on the agenda and we've added them to a new agenda that's no longer in order of the last agenda. So we're going to start today with Joan White, and she's going to talk a little bit about the research that she's been doing about sex offender programs in other states.
My name is Joan White, and I work in the Office of Senate Counsel and Research, and staff the Health and Human Services Committee. This is not. It's to do a comparison of state programs related to sexually violent persons. And I want to preface this presentation with the fact that but I did try to keep the highlights of the differences in those programs. And if you do have questions.
No, you are not actually by a microphone.
Oh, goodness. Is this, so, hello?
That works, but you're not close enough to it, I think.
Can you hear me now?
Can you hear me now?
Okay, this is the most important part of my presentation. So if you do have questions, I will more than likely have to write them down and get back to you. But I will try to answer the questions you have. But like I said, I'm not an expert, and if you do have questions that I can't answer, I will be more than happy to get back to you. So this is related to the other states that have adopted civil commitment laws related to sexually violent persons. And there's 20 states that have passed legislation authorizing civil commitment of sexually dangerous persons, and the most recent are Nebraska, which passed legislation in 2006, and New Hampshire and New York, which passed legislation in 2007. And the sexual predator laws conform in many aspects. The commitment follows a criminal sentence. The laws target repeat sexual offenders, and evidence regarding the individual's likelihood of future violence is central to the decision-making in the commitment. And in comparing the sexually violent person laws, there's variations in defining the pool of offenders eligible for commitment. And I did a memo, and there's an attachment which reflects several things that you might want to pull out. The first is the attachment is entitled State Comparison of Civil Commitment of Sexually Violent Predators. It's a September 24th memo.
Stapled to the back of the memo so that we could do two-sided copying.
And the first column provides information on the commitment eligibility for each state. And they're relatively similar, but California is one. It requires that the individual eligible for commitment have two or more victims. Also, at least three states specifically provide that juveniles can be considered for commitment, and those states are Illinois, Washington, and Wisconsin. This handout also reflects the standard of dangerousness that the state must prove in order to civilly commit the individual. And it also lists the states that allow a jury trial and the differences in the burden of proof that the state must meet in order to commit the individual. A majority of the states have adopted the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. which is the standard of proof, a higher standard of proof than used in criminal proceedings. Florida, Minnesota, New Jersey, and North Dakota authorize a lower standard of clear and convincing evidence to commit the person as a sexually violent predator. Also reflected in this handout is information related to where the person is placed following commitment. In California, there's a time-limited confinement of 2 years, which distinguishes it from other states that have indeterminate periods of commitment. A person cannot be held in California for more than 2 years unless the court extends the commitment by granting a new petition for commitment, placing the burden on the state to prove that the individual is still a sexually violent predator, and that burden of proof is beyond a reasonable doubt.
So, Ms. White, how many do they review every year in California?
I
guess another way to ask the question would be how many get out?
There's another attachment which I was going to get to later, which it's called a profile of civil commitment around the country. In California currently has 443 people committed. At the snapshot when this was done, that's how many they had committed. And there's been 59 people fully discharged. And this was based on numbers in the fall of 2006. The Pennsylvania law, which was passed in 2003, establishes a program for 20-year-olds who are aging out of the juvenile system who are found to pose a high risk of reoffending. The Texas law is very unique. Texas does not physically confine the patient, but instead the treatment occurs on an outpatient setting, not in a treatment facility. And the patients live in their own residences, are allowed to work in the community, subject to an electronic monitoring and device and treatment requirements, which include weekly treatment sessions. And failure to comply with this order of commitment can result in a third-degree felony charge, which may result in incarceration.
And I don't know if you know this, but how many have been incarcerated? How many of those in the program?
I have emailed the states related to the recidivism rate, and I only heard back from one, and they wanted clarification. So trying to get the information. But I'm trying to get that information.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, Ms. White, in Pennsylvania, do they not have another program only for the 20-year-olds who are aging out of the juvenile system?
That's the only program they have. The handout in the last column provides the release authority, and one major difference between Minnesota and the other states is that the release authority is made by the court in other states and by the commissioner in Minnesota. Release determination in Minnesota is based on recommendations made by a 3-member special review board comprised of an attorney, a psychiatrist, and a mental health professional. The patient does have the right to appeal this to a Supreme Court appeal panel, which we've created, and then from there to the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court. But the initial petition goes to the court in other states, and here it goes to this panel, which I realize is very different here. Also, generally in other states, an annual examination of the person's mental condition is conducted, and a report is provided to the court. If the state wants to extend the patient's commitment, the state has a burden to prove that the committed person's mental abnormality or personality disorder remains such that the person is not safe to be at large, and if released, is likely to engage in acts of sexual violence. Also, standard release criteria common to the states that provide release and discharge through the court include that the committed individual has made significant progress while in treatment, and that progress is sustainable. it is substantially probable that the committed individual will not engage in an act of future sexual violence. Release to propose less restrictive alternative is in the best interests of the committed individual. And conditions can be imposed that would adequately protect the community. Several state statutes direct the reviewing judge to provide additional conditions in order to discharge or release the patient. Some of the conditions have included the use of the GPS monitoring system to track the whereabouts of the released individuals. Florida, Missouri, Texas, and Virginia require the GPS system, and Arizona uses it in certain circumstances. Also, related to the conditional release, many states have a tiered approach. In Arizona, the first step of a conditional release is that the resident lives at the facility with a movement into the community, which involves securing employment. The next step is to restricted housing in the community. And the last level allows the patient to find housing, but the Department of Human Services reviews that housing site. And also, they may also require the person to wear a GPS monitoring device during any of these steps. The other document that I referred to earlier is the profile of civil commitment around the country. This provides a snapshot of programs in the fall of 2006. And it reflects, at that point in time, the number of people who were committed, the year their sexually violent predator law was passed, the youngest, oldest, and average age of the people committed, whether there's any women, race, the total number of people fully discharged, the number of people on conditional release at that point in time, the average cost per person committed, the average cost per inmate in a prison, and then the total commitment budget in millions.
And Ms. White, under the column that says totally ever fully discharged, would that include people that would be on the GPS system in states at their discharge, or would it be people that were no longer on GPS at all?
It's my understanding that four states do require them to continue on GPS. That's my understanding. I can double check on that.
But those numbers of those that are on GPS would be included in the discharge column?
Yes.
Okay.
And I included this document. It was provided to me by the Department of Human Services, and I just thought it was a good overview of the programs in different states. You also asked for information related to treatment and the treatment differences in the programs, and I've attached a document entitled State Comparison of Treatment Hours in Civil Commitment Programs. And this document compares the treatment hours in those programs around the country. And this document was provided by the Department of Human Services, so I would defer any questions related to this document to them, because I'm not real familiar with exactly the treatment and the hours.
I guess the only question I would have is, are these apples-to-apples comparisons? Or are there some components that are considered treatment in one state that are considered something else in another state? Yeah.
Madam Chair, my name is Wes Koyser from the Department of Human Services. I think that's kind of the question that we have as we interview other states. Sometimes it's difficult to get apples to apples comparisons. This was the beginning of a chart that we were filling out, and we wanted to share it with Ms. White in her efforts, and we're continuing to try to gather this information. And it's the same thing with costs, by the way. When you start talking to other states about costs, what's included in per diems differ from state to state. So I think we have a continued effort going on in trying to get this information, but it is a challenge to make it apples to apples.
And then, Ms. White, one of the questions I have about this chart, the one that is a profile of civil commitment around the country, under the state of Arizona, we have 71 people that are committed, and we've got 81 that have ever been fully discharged. So does that mean that they have a lot of mobility, and so they had 71 committed at the time this chart was made up, but over time they've had many more than that?
Yes, that's true. At the time this chart was done, they had 71 people committed. But total, since the law was passed in 95, they've discharged 81. And I also checked, the other strange thing about this chart in Arizona is that it says they have 71 people committed, 69 are on conditional supervised or transitional release. The woman from Arizona indicated that she thinks these numbers are wrong. They had just a couple on conditional release, but 71 were admitted to the facility. So that was another.
Are there any other questions about this research that Ms. White did? Yes, Representative Lieber.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just going back a little bit to where you were talking about the different states, and there was the first chart that we were looking at when you were talking about in most of the states the court makes a release decision. And from what you were describing, the factors, it sounded like the burden is on the committed person at that point. Was I right in hearing it that way, most of the states? Or who bears the burden of showing, of proving up those factors?
It's my understanding that the burden is on the state to prove that they should continue to be committed. But here in Minnesota, it seems like the burden is more on the patient to prove that. The state does have a slight burden, but the patient has. Kathy Pontius is our judiciary counsel, and she knows
she's
a little bit more.
She's going to be up next. So.
But generally, the burden is on the state to prove that they should continue to be committed.
Okay. No, it's just the way you stated it, if I understood you correctly, the factors that you went through talking about what the court looks at in the different states, the way you stated it, it sounded as though there had to be a proof that the person could be released rather than the other way around.
Well, it's kind of a dual. The state has a burden to prove that the person should is a sexually violent person and should continue to be committed. But in addition to that, then the person has to prove that they have access to treatment and housing, and there are conditions that can be met that will make sure that it is this, you know, it's kind of the STEP program. It depending on where they are, depends on what they need to prove. Generally, there's a burden on the state that they should continue to be committed.
Chair?
Yes, Representative
Tamer. Just a quick question on the costs in Minnesota compared to other states. And are you including the cost to counties and the average cost per person, or is that just the cost to the state?
Are you looking at the...
I'm looking at the profile of civil commitment chart around the country.
I tried to get the information from the New York Times, trying to determine what costs were included in this, and I have not been able to get that information yet.
I guess I'm just asking about, Madam Chair, about Minnesota. Is that state and county costs or just state?
Representative, I asked for some sort of a templater. What did they ask for in coming up with these costs? And I haven't gotten the information yet, so I do not know.
Okay, thank you.
But once I get it, I will to you.
The other question would be, are all of these from the same year? Is all this information collected for the same year? I mean, it looks like at least some of it was July 2006, but...
I can find that out, too. Thank you.
Thank you. Not easy to pull all this together. Kathleen Pontius? I might just say while she's coming up here that I just find it fascinating the differences in these programs around the country, and especially the differences in the discharge rate.
Madam Chair and members, I'm Kathleen Pontius, counsel for the Judiciary Committee, and you should have a memo in your packet of materials that I prepared along with a number of statutes that are attached. And basically, what I put together is just a very brief legislative history of our commitment law relating to sexual offenders, and then also an overview of what the current Minnesota statutes are. I tried in particular to focus on the statutes dealing with past eligible status, transfer, provisional discharge, and discharge, and so it seems to be the areas of interest for this committee. Minnesota's Psychopathic Personality Commitment Act was first enacted in 1939. The major activity that next took place was in 1994, basically in response to a couple of key decisions of the Minnesota Supreme Court dealing with the commitment law. Probably the most significant one that you all have heard of is N. Ray Linehan. Mr. Linehan, I think at this point, has had either three or four cases before the Minnesota Supreme Court. This was the first one. And the court had already held that the Psychopathic Personality Act was constitutional, although in doing so, it kind of read some additional language that was not specifically in the statute. In particular, it found that what was called the, I think it was the utter inability test, but which basically was that a person had to show a habitual course of misconduct in sexual matters and an utter lack of power to control the person's sexual impulses. And that was part of the court's reasoning in terms of upholding the constitutionality of the statute. What happened in the first Linehan case was that the court found that the state failed to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the former inmate utterly lacked the power to control his sexual impulses. And essentially, this prompted a special session of the legislature in 1994. At that time, Attorney General Skip Humphrey had a task force that came in with recommendations, and that laid the framework for the law that's in effect now. And what the legislature did basically was to come up with two different grounds for committing persons under the statute. The first was the sexual psychopathic personality, and the second was a sexually dangerous person. And basically what the sexual psychopathic personality statute was just reenact the old law. And one reason that was done was sort of as a fail-safe because the court had already upheld the constitutionality of the law, and it was pretty apparent that any attempt to come up with a new standard was likely to meet a constitutional challenge. So... the Attorney General's office suggested keeping that old definition in the law and then adding this new concept of a sexually dangerous person. And the most notable difference between those two criteria is that in order for a person to be considered sexually dangerous, they do not have to exhibit an utter lack of power to control their sexual impulses. And in fact, the statute specifically states that it's not necessary to prove this as an element. However, you have to go forward then to the next, the last Supreme Court case dealing with Linehan, which was issued in 1999. And there again, the court had an appeal as to whether the statute was constitutional, whether it was an ex post facto law, or violated the double jeopardy clause. and the court had ruled that it was constitutional. That case was then appealed, and cert was granted by the United States Supreme Court. In the meantime, it issued a decision in a case coming out of the state of Kansas that sort of laid the groundwork that the United States Supreme Court would use in determining the constitutionality of statutes. So the case was actually remanded back to Minnesota. And what the Supreme Court did at that time was, again, to read some language into the statute that does not actually appear in the law right now. It looked back at the legislative history and noted that when the statute was enacted in 94, the state wanted to get away from this sort of utter inability to control concept. But at the same time, in order for the statute to be constitutional, particularly in light of the Kansas case, that there still had to be some showing that the person, that whatever mental disorder dysfunction that they have does not allow them to control their impulses, therefore making it likely that they'd be highly likely to engage in acts of harmful sexual conduct in the future. So even though that language is not in the statute, that's how the Supreme Court has interpreted it. And then if you look at, there's a number of statutes attached to my memo dealing with the release or discharge of committed sex offenders. Basically, there's sort of kind of different areas. You've got past eligible status that they can get. They can request a transfer to a less secure treatment facility. They can try to get a provisional discharge or an actual discharge from commitment. Now, unlike the general commitment law, under which commitments are for a determinate period of time, generally not to exceed 6 months, once a person is fully committed as a sexual psychopathic personality or a sexually dangerous person, it is an indeterminate commitment. So it's basically up to them to come back in. They're entitled to reviews every 6 months to try to either get a release or a discharge or some other lower status short of a discharge. And with respect to the past plans, those are decisions that can be made by a medical director of a treatment facility. Excuse me. However, if an interested person objects after that decision is made, you know, most commonly, say, the county attorney who made the initial commitment, then it can be reviewed by a special review board, and then the commissioner makes a determination based on recommendations from the special review board, and that in turn can be appealed to a judicial appeal panel. With respect to the provisional discharges and the discharges, all of those decisions go through the special review board process, which then is subject to a final decision by the Commissioner of Human Services, and then can be appealed to the judicial appeal panel. And so I know there was some discussion earlier with respect to the burdens of proof that apply in the different stages. You know, with respect to the initial commitment, that is a clear and convincing evidence standard that the committing authority, like the county attorney, has the burden of proving. So they have to approve by clear and convincing evidence that the person meets the definitions in the statute. When you get to the after the commitment, when you get into the earlier decisions as far as a discharge or treatment, the statute doesn't specifically get into a burden of proof at that point. It just requires the commissioner making, the special review board makes a recommendation based on the testimony that it's gotten and the evidence it's received both from the patient and opposing parties, then makes a recommendation to the commissioner who makes a final determination. That in turn, though, once that, if that is appealed to this judicial appeal panel, then it's kind of a two-step process. Generally, the patient would have sort of the first burden or the first step of producing what's called like a prima facie case. So they just have to show evidence that they meet the criteria, either for a pass or a temporary or provisional or a permanent discharge. Once they make that showing, the burden essentially shifts then to the person, i.e. the county attorney, let's say, opposing the discharge. And then they have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the person is still in need of commitment at that point in time. So it kind of varies depending on at what point in the process that you're at. The statute itself, actually, under the judicial review panel, just speaks in terms of discharges. And there has not been a lot of reported case law under this. I did find a 2004 Court of Appeals decision where a patient was appealing deniable of past eligible status. And the Court of Appeals held that basically the same rules applied not just to discharges, but to the pass eligible status, and presumably also to, say, a provisional discharge as well. In that case, the patient had made a basic showing that he was eligible for pass eligible status, and at which point the court said then the county attorney had the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that he shouldn't get a pass. So that, to the extent that clears up the burden of proof question, I can look into that more, answer more questions. But it varies depending on where you're at in the process. And I think I've included copies of all the statutes and the definitions that go along with them for your interest, as well as a copy of the pre-94 psychopathic personality statute. And, beyond that, I'd be happy to answer any more specific questions or look into issues further.
Questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it possible to get numbers of who has made it to which stage of the process of attempting to get out? Because at this point, I'd like to know if, you know, anyone has made their prima facie case, how many people have been stopped then from getting out, and just what the details really are.
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's a good question. It's one I have myself. I don't have the numbers. I don't know if the department has collected anything.
Well, there are some numbers.
I assume they're out there.
Pretty scarce, but there are some. We can get that for you. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question on the definition of a sexual psychopathic personality. And I wasn't in the legislature when the law was created, but is that definition, is that spelled out like in the DSM-4? Is that it's not?
Madam Chair, Representative Paymar, I have to defer to one of the experts behind me on that question. I don't know.
The reason I'm asking the question, maybe there's someone else that's going to testify, Madam Chair, I just don't know the answer to this, but this whole notion that that the offender has an inability to control his or her sexual impulses, I was always under the impression that the act of rape was more of an issue of power and domination over someone, and not that the sexual impulse aspect wasn't part of the whole equation, but if it's an issue of power and domination, why is the only criteria whether the individual has an inability to control his or her sexual impulses? And that's where I wanted to know if the DSM-4 was defining that for the state. Is that clear?
Well, we can have them. They're going to come up in a minute. Why don't we see if there are any more questions for Ms. Pontius? And my comment to you would be that not everybody fits exactly the same kind of profile. So I know we think they do, but they don't always. So.
Well, I'd like some clarification when this legislature, maybe Senator Neville, you were here, when you were deciding what criteria someone should be committed for. I mean, you must have had that debate.
I think we're having more discussion about it now than we did at the time, actually.
Madam Chair?
Unfortunately.
My recollection is that question was asked, and maybe something has changed in the meantime, but back then I don't think there was a recognized mental illness that would have fit. It's just more of a personality disorder, I guess.
My recollection of it was that we were tweaking the law enough to meet a specific circumstance that was confronting us, and we did not necessarily discuss it in the broader context of the decades and decades and decades following that it would apply. Typical of the way we do things, I might add. So, any other questions for Ms. Pontius? Thank you very much for your work. Deputy Commissioner Dennis Benson, coming forward to discuss a good time.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Institutions Division in the Department of Corrections. I'm going to spend a couple moments on the good time issue that has come up from time to time over the last couple of years. And I'm going to try to make this as simple as I can. But back in 1980, when we went to the sentencing guidelines system, we were sentencing offenders to what we refer to as two-thirds, one-third. In other words, a 30-month sentence would result in 20 months of incarceration and 10 months on supervision or supervised release. They could fail to earn that 10 months of supervised, or they could fail to earn some of that SRD time if they got themselves into difficulty in the institution. In other words, if they went to segregation for 30 days, they would lose or fail to earn 10 days of good time. So 10 days would be added to that first 20 months. And then in 1993, there was a move afoot to try to get states to come into compliance with truth in sentencing. And truth in sentencing was important because federal dollars through VOITAS was being made available to states to build prison beds, but they had to have a truth in sentencing statute. So basically what we did, or what Minnesota did, what the legislature did, was change the statute slightly so that you would actually get two sentences at the time of sentencing. In other words, you would get, for that same 30-month sentence, you would get 20 months of incarceration time and 10 months of supervision time. And again, if you had difficulty in the prison system and ended up in segregation for 30 days, then the formula, the 3-for-1 formula, was applied so that you would not, we could extend the incarceration time if you got a segregation sentence of, again, if you got 30 days, that would result in extending your incarceration by 10 days. So it's the same formula, but we came at it a little bit differently so that we could come into compliance with the truth in sentencing requirement and consistent with our statute at that time. I guess for the sake of our discussion here today, why this is important is because we have, in the past, and we continue to do it today, we have extended incarceration time for offenders, particularly sex offenders and CD, chemical dependency offenders, who refuse to participate in treatment. And we have a couple of different formulas that we have used. And basically, if someone refuses to go to treatment for chemical dependency or sex offender treatment in our system, we would extend their incarceration again by 30 days if they sign a waiver. If they want to take it to a hearing, it would be 45 days. And the same for sex offenders. But again, if they've been designated to the treatment or sex offender treatment program up at Moose Lake, which is in our facility, but treatment is provided by the DHS staff, we would... And again, if they refuse treatment or they failed in treatment or were dismissed from treatment, we would let them sign a waiver for, I believe it's 360 days. If they did not sign a waiver and took it to a hearing, it would be 540 days. So we have a history of holding them accountable for complying with treatment directives in our agency. So again, we would do this once. We don't any longer have multiple convictions or signing of waivers for fail or refusing to participate in treatment or failing treatment. One more piece of this that I'd just like to discuss with you. We've had our Hearings and Release Unit do a little research on the individuals that are under dual commitment, those people that are still under a correction sentence, still committed to the Commissioner of Corrections, who have since been civilly committed and are now in the DHS system under their commitment as well for civil commitment. And again, they're technically on release from corrections over to DHS. So again, if somebody refuses treatment over in the DHS facility, we go through what we call a violation hearing. And if they have violated the conditions of their release, and of course somebody is civilly committed, one of the conditions would be that they actively participate in treatment, they would be violated and brought back to corrections. Now, this is relatively new. This is new in the last year or two, and it's an administrative process and procedure that seems to be working pretty well. I can tell you that the numbers are we've had 27 who have violated the conditions of their release in DHS, and 24 of them have been returned to corrections. Five of them have been continued to the expiration of their correction sentence. So those people who are creating problems in the DHS treatment environment and are under dual commitment to corrections, we have successfully brought them back to corrections and kept them in a cheaper bed because they've either failed treatment or refused to participate. So again, with the advent of the Office of Special Investigations over in DHS, I think we're working well together with respect to trying to get a handle on these dual commits, and those that are creating problems for DHS are coming back to corrections. So that's a little bit of a departure from good time, but it's consistent with the way we would manage offenders in who are under our jurisdiction, who are on some level of supervised release. We would violate them, bring them back to prison. Some we might bring back for 30, 60, 90 days or a year. Others we could continue to the expiration of their sentence. I don't have the exact numbers, but I believe several of these DHS offenders that are back with us have been continued with us for 365 days, and then they might get another shot at treatment over there. If it doesn't work, they could be violated again up until they reach the expiration of their correction sentence, that last third. So we thought we might try to clarify some of those things that might be helpful to the committee. In addition to that, there were several questions and issues raised last time. I believe you have a handout in your file, and I've got Nan Larson and Steve Allen here again that are going to very quickly walk through that for you, and then we're happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Steve Allen, the Director of Behavioral Health Services with the Department of Corrections.
Before we start this part of the presentation, I think there was a question Representative Hillstrom had about.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Commissioner Benson, you stated that you extend time for people who are not participating in sex offender treatment or drug or alcohol treatment. But at the previous hearing, we were told that there were not enough treatment beds for everyone that is court-ordered to get treatment. So how do you determine who you're going to extend sentences for, given the fact that you don't have enough treatment beds to offer? And do you have a climate of people seeing that some people don't have to participate, even though they've been court-ordered? And then why do they get an extended sentence for not doing the treatment?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, well, first of all, they're not court-ordered. They're simply, they get a directive. They get what we refer to as a directive. When they go through the assessment process, they are directed into treatment, and they are become part of a list, the list that we talked about last time we met, and I can certainly ask Steve or Nan to clarify that. But Then when they get to the point where they're going to be offered treatment, at that point, if they refuse treatment, then the due process system would kick in, and we would extend their incarceration time if they refuse treatment. For those that enter treatment and fail treatment or leave treatment, again, they would go to the due process system, and they would get that sanction. So it's those people that have the opportunity or are involved in the opportunity and either refuse the opportunity or blow the opportunity are the ones that would be subject to the extended incarceration time.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow-up then would be, what percentage of those who need treatment actually have access to it?
Madam Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I think I will defer to Nan and Steve. I think our numbers were, I think we release almost 80% of sex offenders without sex offender treatment. So it's only a small percentage that we're able to, given our number of beds, offer treatment to. And
well, I think for the purpose of this hearing, we'd be most interested in knowing about the level threes.
Madam Chair,
many level threes have not been given treatment or offered treatment while they've been in the correction system?
Madam Chair and members, I wonder if I might walk through this responses to the questions that may partially answer it, and then to the extent that it doesn't, I can look for additional information. One of the questions that came from last time is how many level three sex offenders are refusing treatment? And just a point of note for this committee is that neither the offenders nor the treatment providers know which offenders are going to be designated at level three at the time treatment is offered. That determination is made quite late in the sentencing, and we do that on purpose. The committee that decides what level an offender will be at likes to look at does a very thorough review and prefers to look at the most recent information just prior to release, including progress in treatment. We did, however, look at, we went back from fiscal year 2002 through 2007, and 38 level three offenders were offered a treatment opportunity and refused while incarcerated. We took it a step further, wondering what happened to those 38 offenders after that. 24 of the 38 are currently incarcerated in the department. 3 of the 38 are out in the community on intensive supervised release. 2 are civilly committed to the DHS program in Moose Lake. 7 are at St. Peter in the DHS program there. And 2 offenders' sentences have expired, and they currently reside out of state.
Now, I would just like to say that I think, while this is a fair snapshot from fiscal year 02 to fiscal year 07, I would say that during that period of time, things changed a lot, because this was a period of time when not all level three offenders were automatically being referred to the courts for consideration for commitment. So we need to remember that when we look at these numbers.
Okay. We were also asked how many offenders are released without treatment. As Deputy Commissioner Benson mentioned, it's about 20% of the offenders that are being released having had a treatment opportunity. Looking ahead to fiscal year 08, we estimate 840 sex offenders will be released who have treatment directives. We estimate about 600 to 650 of them will be released without a treatment opportunity. Looking back to fiscal year 07, 823 sex offenders were released. We treated 169 of them. 79 completed it or participated successfully to their release. That's about half of that group. And the remaining were adversely terminated, such as they quit, they were administratively discharged, they had discipline problems and were terminated from the program, that type of thing. We were asked how many offenders are on the waiting list for treatment, and we're providing additional information here. There are about 1,600 offenders currently in the Department of Corrections incarcerated in our facilities who are directed to complete sex offender treatment and haven't yet fulfilled that directive. With the bringing on of our Rush City program, we estimate being able to treat or provide about 200 treatment opportunities a year. So by using that math, we'll be able to get to about 20% of them prior to their release. I would just remind this committee, for those offenders who do not fully complete treatment or are not offered treatment opportunities and yet are directed to treatment, they are directed to attend treatment after release. The next item, we provided in the last meeting a breakdown of our per diem cost, and there was some interest in this committee in sort of doing an apples and apples comparison with the DHS numbers. The numbers that we provided last time, if you'll recall, couldn't quite be added together. We had a statutory per diem, and we had broken out our sex offender treatment cost as they would be per bed in one of our sex offender treatment programs. Those two numbers couldn't quite be added together because we include the cost of sex offender treatment in our mental health per diem. We've now broken that out, and that number that combines our statutory per diem along with our sex offender treatment cost would be $121.86. What would be the cost to treat all sex offenders? Challenging question. We're giving you a fairly straightforward response now, but with quite a few caveats. If we're treating approximately 20% of the offenders now, and our annual budget for sex offender treatment is about $2.2 million, multiplying that $2.2 million by five takes us to about $11 million. That's a very rough estimate. One of the things that it would be important for this committee to understand is that the underutilized space in the Department of Corrections has been utilized over the years. We have no space currently to provide additional programming, whether it be sex offender treatment programming, chemical dependency programming, or other types of programming. So if we're going to add to our programming, we would need to look at capital costs and design costs associated with building new programming space. In addition, there may be additional security staff that are required to staff programming space. Another consideration is it's very challenging for us to hire qualified sex offender treatment personnel. It takes a long time to train them. There is no school to go to that persons come out being trained in sex offender work. We essentially have to grow our own. That's a long process, and so we can't just greatly expand sex offender treatment programming in our facilities without also having a good solid plan to bring in additional qualified sex offender treatment staff. And site selection for sex offender programming would be critical based on location needs, the custody level of the offenders that we'd be trying to treat. A couple of these items I'm walking through this document. I think you have two. I'm walking through this document. There's a couple of these items that will be responded to by DHS. All right. The recidivism rates, have they changed since 2003? We don't have those numbers yet, and the reason for that is in doing comparison with recidivism rates across our own data and across other states, we like to have at least 3 years post-release, preferably more. That data for the 2003 cohort should be available soon after the first of the year. The 2004 cohort should be available sometime this coming summer. So, and we will provide this committee that data when it's completed. We made reference last meeting to a sex offender recidivism study that was recently completed in April 07. In the PowerPoint handout, we have a reference to that, and I would encourage you to take a look at that. That's on our website. And I understand we also have an additional handout that gives a brief overview of those results. And that's it for my formal remarks. Any questions?
Are there questions? Yes, Senator Dunham.
Madam Chair, I've seen some numbers on recidivism that sex offenders are substantially lower for recidivism, under 10% if they get the proper treatment. Have you seen those numbers? Does that sound like it's in the ballpark?
Yes, that's well spelled out in our 2007 study. If you take the cutting across those cohorts from 2000 through 2002, those 12 years, the average recidivism rate over a 10-year period was approximately 10%.
And Madam Chair, couple other questions. This kind of dovetails on Representative Paymar's question, but are the people that are getting sex offender treatment, do they have a specific DSM diagnosis of something? Is there such a thing as a sex offender diagnosis that you can treat it like a mental illness, or is it something, some different kind of animal here?
Well, there's two questions that were floating around. One was about, and this is not my area of expertise, I want to make that clear, and it is an area of expertise. Sexually dangerous laws across the country are not mental health definitions. You won't find them in the DSM-4. They're a legal definition, and they do vary by state. There's many different reasons why sex offenders reoffend or offend to begin with, and there is no one diagnosis for sex offending. It's common that some sex offenders have problems, including personality, access to what we would call access to personality disorders. They may or may not have other mental health disorders. The sex offenders in our program are highly likely to have chemical dependency problems in the range of 75%. But there is no one diagnosis for a rapist, for instance.
Madam Chair, one more question.
Senator,
I read, in fact, just this morning in the Wall Street Journal, something about Project Innocence and that how DNA has exonerated a couple of hundred people just through that project. They were talking this morning about a sex offender who, after 24 years in prison, was acquitted. If you get a person who's been convicted and ordered to treatment, or even recommended just to treatment, and they proclaim their innocence, is that considered a refusal to participate in treatment for which they might lose good time or have other sanctions?
You've asked a very good question. As a treatment provider, when an offender denies having committed the sex offense, we don't quite always know how to approach that. We trust the legal system. Obviously, the legal system can be wrong, but it's frankly hard work to get convicted in our legal system. There's many, if you look at the data, there's many cases that come to the court's attention that aren't fully prosecuted, and so we need to trust the legal system as they move forward, that if someone comes in front of us with a conviction for a sexual offense, that they have likely committed that offense, and so we take that as a starting point. We do have offenders. What we ask in the beginning is that they participate in the treatment process. We, in those cases where the offense is being denied in the front end, we look at other areas where the person can engage in the treatment process. Eventually, however, we do need to talk about the offense, and then we sort of cross that bridge when we come to it. Good question.
Well, Madam Chair, let me dig a little deeper on that. I mean, when you cross that fence or that bridge, how have they been resolved in the past then? I mean, it sounds from your answer that you can participate in the program without admitting your guilt to the specific offense that brought you to prison up to a point.
Yes.
But there is a point at which you have to admit to the offense, I gather from your answer, or you are now not participating and you'll be getting some kind of sanction. Is that...
Yes, there's
the
a point. There's a point where the purpose of sex offender treatment is to deal with the sexual offense, and if the person involved in treatment is not admitting to a sexual offense, that there's just no point in completing that process.
All right.
Other questions, Representative Abley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. There was a question before that dealt with not only the sex offender treatment but the chemical dependency treatment, and you just mentioned something about many of these offenders having chemical dependency issues as well. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about some of the data on that, of these sex offenders, how many of them will be determined to need chemical dependency treatment? And then of those, how many of them will get it? Do you know that, or is that something that you'd have to go and dig out some data on?
If I'm understanding your question, approximately 75% of our sex offenders are diagnosed with a chemical dependency problem that requires treatment. Was that your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then how many of those would we already have been told here that only 20% will get the sex offender treatment. What percentage of those who are determined to need it will get the chemical dependency treatment in the prison system?
It varies somewhat by our program. Our Lionel Lakes program was built with a enclosed chemical dependency track within that program. Most of the sex offenders who have chemical dependency needs are treated within that program. We are taking a hard look at that issue and looking at how we can build in sex offender-specific chemical dependency treatment elsewhere in our system. Sex offenders tend to be more successful when there's a program that's built around both their chemical dependency and sex offender unique needs.
Madam Chair, if I can add something for the record, I'm Nan Larson. I'm the Director of Health Services for the department. Because much of our population needs chemical dependency treatment, the sex offenders in many instances end up going into the same pool as all of the rest of our offenders who need chemical dependency programming. So we also assess them upon intake for chemical dependency needs and prioritize them as well based on their risk and their need. So in some instances, if they're not in the Lionel Lakes program where we do have that chemical dependency track, they'll be prioritized with the rest of our population who needs CD treatment.
There was a question about level 3 sex offenders and the extent to which they are afforded treatment opportunities. In fiscal year 2007, 48 level 3 sex offenders were offered a treatment opportunity, which was about 30% of that group. 91 were released without having a treatment opportunity.
Madam Chair.
And then of those 91 that were released without a treatment opportunity, how many of them were committed?
I can't answer that at this time, but we can try to gather that data. I would also note that the process of commitment takes some time, and we note that it can take up to a year for the courts to work through its system as it makes a final determination.
Well, we know that. We're making sure that it happens before they get out.
Madam Chair, one other point to note is that if we have an offender who is released as a part of their conditions of release, if they're directed to sex offender treatment while in prison and are not offered the opportunity, they will be directed to sex offender treatment in the community as a condition of their release.
Are there other questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So those that are directed to get treatment in the community, how do they pay for it? Do they have insurance? Do they have access? What are we doing to make sure that they get this treatment that we have deemed that they need?
I'm not in a position to provide the best answer to that. My understanding is that there are state dollars that go to support programs in the community, and so that at least some of those opportunities are supported by state dollars.
Madam Chair, we're being told that there are some grants available, $2.5 million worth of funding for sex offender treatment in the community.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Madam Chair, just one final sum up of where I've been going with all of these questions. If we get these offenders and we don't get them treatment and we don't get them chemical dependency treatment, they come back. They come back often enough, and the next thing you know, we're civilly committing them. So if we don't get them the treatment that they need, we are just adding to the problem of having all of these offenders civilly committed.
Representative Liebling, did you have a question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, really, I had pretty much the same question about, so they're on their conditional release and they're ordered to have the sex offender treatment in the community. And, you know, how many of them are actually then treatment? I guess that was the same question because, I'm sure there are some grants to the local corrections agencies to help with pay for that treatment, but that doesn't give me a lot of comfort level here. I'm sure that Representative Ilstrom is feeling the same way.
Well, I assume if they don't get the treatment somehow, then they're violated and they return to the correction system. We don't just say, oh, well, too bad. I mean...
Well, Madam Chair, I'm sure that's true, but, then the question is, are we making it possible for them to actually be successful? I mean, it sounds like a lot of what we're doing here is kind of shooting ourselves in the foot by...
I believe that there are ways we could do this better, or we wouldn't all be sitting here talking about it. That's for darn sure. Commissioner?
Madam Chair and members, again, I think we mentioned it last time that we met, but I'd just like to make the point again that in the last year now, particularly the last 4 or 5, 6 months, the Department of Corrections and the Department of Human Services have been trying to take a more global and complete look at this issue, because it really does fall to the feet of both agencies. And I would be the first to admit that we don't have a seamless system. I think we might be committing people that if we had more treatment at a different level, we could divert some of those individuals from being committed. And conversely, I think we're releasing some people that probably need more treatment. I don't think there's any doubt about that. So we are, again, we're meeting frequently to try to come up with some proposals that might make for a more seamless system, and the net might be wider, but at the same time, I think that it would enhance public safety and would be targeting those people who really need to get into treatment at some point during their incarceration. And if they do, then maybe we could divert some of those folks from those very expensive civil commitment beds. So we are talking about that, and hopefully we can be helpful, too, in this process as try to provide some semblance of not a complete solution, but an enhanced approach to treating these individuals.
So, Deputy Commissioner Benson, I know that you're working together, and I commend that, and I do see some improvements that have been made, but we still are on a fairly steep trajectory of spending increased dollars hand over fist in the area of these committed individuals. So I think we need to continue to work on it. Now, the question that I have for you is, when you do this assessment to determine the risk level for individuals in need of treatment, how is it that all of the individuals that probably will be assessed as being at level 3 prior to their release are not found to be at a risk factor that would be high enough so every one of them would actually be recommended for treatment before they're released?
Madam Chair, as Steve Allen indicated earlier, part of the issue there is the level 3 designation isn't determined until very late in the incarceration period. So for many of these people, it's an issue of time.
Well, I understand that it's done very late in the process, but the assessment to determine their risk for needing treatment is not done late in the process. And it would seem to me like somehow there would be, maybe not identical, but some correlation between their risk for need of treatment and their risk of becoming a level 3 designee upon release. I mean, is that unreasonable to assume there'd be some correlation between those two?
Yes, Madam Chair, members, we have taken a look at that, and our risk assessment tools that show whether a sex offender is at high risk compared to others does correlate very well with the level three process. In other words, most offenders who score high on these risk assessments instruments are also subsequently designated as level three offenders prior to their release. In our sex offender treatment programs, we're targeting those offenders who are at high risk, and we capture a higher proportion of the high-risk offenders into our treatment program than moderate or low-risk offenders for that very reason, that we're trying to spend our resources where we hope that they'll do the most good. Also, there's the subgroup of those offenders who are designated to be at high risk who are sent to the MSOP program in our Moose Lake prison for that reason as well, seeing that we expect them to be at high risk for commitment. So we're trying to divert our resources to those high-risk offenders.
Well, when you were talking to us earlier about this, you indicated that about half of the people that are released as level three sex offenders were offered treatment and about half were not. So if you call half a high level of people getting into treatment because of a risk assessment, I would beg to differ with you.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry if there's a misunderstanding. We are targeting those that are at high risk. We don't have enough treatment beds to treat all that we would like to.
Well, all I can say is shame on us. How penny wise and pound foolish. I mean, so we're going to take somebody who we didn't have enough money. I mean, you must have had some people that you provided treatment to who were not risky enough to be designated level three sex offenders at release. So, you know, to some extent it would be a matter of priorities, but, you know, then shame on us if we're not giving you enough money, because, I mean, an $80 a day per diem payment to me looks damn good compared to $300 a day for indefinite life, as it seems in Minnesota these commitments end up being. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it possible for us to get the information about of the people that were committed in the last 2 years, how many did not receive the chance for treatment in the Minnesota prison?
They're shaking their heads, yes.
Yeah, I think we can get that for you.
Thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I just would like to add to that, but I'm kind of distressed that with what we know about what you said before about the one of the big factors in this seems to be the chemical dependency issue. And I heard what you said before about the shortage of people who are qualified to treat sex offenders and so on, but chemical dependency is something that we should at least know we have programs for, and presumably we have people who can do it. And it seems to me that at the very least that the sex offenders ought to be getting chemical dependency treatment before they leave prison, even if we can't right now provide the sex offender treatment that they need. And even if we can't do it in a special program that's for sex offenders, I'm just kind of appalled that we're letting sex offenders out of prison that need chemical dependency treatment and are not getting it. And I don't see why we're not prioritizing every sex offender who's in prison.
Madam Chair and members, just to elaborate, we do have a prioritization system with our chemical dependency treatment beds, as we do with our sex offender treatment beds. We have a variety of criteria to reach a high priority level for chemical dependency treatment, but being a sex offender is one of those. And having a diagnosis of chemical dependency plus being a sex offender puts that offender on high priority. And we're not getting to every high priority offender, but we're getting to most of them.
Assistant Commissioner Benson, is the problem that the department hasn't requested more treatment money to meet the need, or is the problem that your requests have been denied?
Madam Chair and members, we have somewhere between 800 and 1,000 inpatient treatment beds in our system. We treat about 1,700
Yeah, 17, 18.
Chemically dependent individuals a year. And obviously, that's not enough beds. But in addition to that, we have to understand that many of these people, by the time they get to prison, they get through the assessment process, many of these people are going out again. Many of them are very short-time offenders.
So are we talking about level three sex offenders are not in prison long enough to be assessed and given treatment?
Madam Chair, no. I think the question that I'm responding to is Senator Liebling's question regarding individuals that come in getting chemical dependency treatment. We don't have enough beds. We certainly don't have enough money. This department has doubled in size in the last 11 years. And even though we've added, I think, a fair number of inpatient treatment beds, and our treatment, by the way, isn't 30 days, it isn't 28 days, it's 6 to 9 months for chemical dependency treatment, we aren't able to reach everybody. And I'm not making excuses. That's just the facts.
But focusing back in on the level threes, are everyone who is at a high enough risk to potentially be a level three on discharge sex offender, therefore referred to the court for evaluation for commitment, are they receiving chemical dependency treatment?
Madam Chair and members, all of them are not, but if they're a high priority and they are directed to sex offender treatment, in their case, the chemical dependency treatment would occur in the sex offender program.
And Madam Chair, may I also add that there are some level threes who come to us, they come to us with a short amount of time. We have to get them assigned a risk level, and they may not have enough time for treatment. So that's an issue as well.
So why do they come
6 months?
Why would that happen? I don't understand that.
Madam Chair, maybe I can clear this up. Harlan Olson, Deputy Commissioner of Community Services. Some of them have been to prison, and they've left the first time as a level one or a level two. They've done their prison time. They're out on supervised release. They violate. They come back. At that point in time, they are back for a period of time that probably is not long enough for treatment, but they are reclassified because of their violation, whether it be for technical offense or whatever. They then are designated level three. So now they are now a level three for the first time. The first or second time they left prison, they may have just been designated a level one or two. So that's how you end up with some level threes leaving prison after they've been back on violations and doing time, and that's why it ends up being a short time to help explain it. Some of them also may have been on probation for a period of time, may have done time in their workhouse up to a year here or there, violated their probation, and come back and get that jail credit that they've already done in the local workhouse, and that's how they can end up leaving as a level three with not a lot of time in prison to do their treatment.
So what percentage of the 50% who are level three who do not get sex offender treatment before they are released would fall in this category?
Madam Chair, we'd have to go back and look at that and give you the accurate answer on that. That can be done.
I think you should do that for us because, you know, if it's a big bunch of them, okay. If it's not, then, you know, that's sort of a sidebar issue here compared to what the larger issue is. Other questions? Senator Neville.
Chair, I want to supplement the question Representative Hillstrom asked. She wants you to gather some data for how many of those who didn't get treatment end up being committed. I'd like to know also how many of the ones who did get treatment got committed. I mean, I'm kind of wondering, is the treatment program that we're giving doing well enough so that it's preventing people from being civilly committed?
Well, Senator Neville, one of the reasons that the question is important in regard to people who are committed is because it is one of the factors. It is one of the factors that gets you to level three, and it is a factor that is considered by the court when they decide to commit. And so,
understood.
You know, there may be some for whom, you know, treatment wasn't going to mitigate their seriousness to start with, but certainly not having it does add to the seriousness.
Madam Chair, I suspect, I understand that, but I wouldn't be surprised if the percentages that are being civilly committed aren't that much different between the ones that are getting the treatment and the ones that aren't. Maybe I'm wrong.
It'd be interesting to find out, but I do know that we didn't used to commit nearly so many as we are today. So, you know, if we were only committing 8 a year, I wouldn't be having this hearing. Yes.
Madam Chair, not to pile on here, but I this document has been very helpful from the last meeting that DHS and DLC put together just to answer the question. So maybe you could just, rather than if you don't have the answers today, you could answer them. I am sort of in this field of treatment, and I, you know, read the research, and Deputy Commissioner Benson, the most recent research on chemical dependency treatment seems to say that long-term treatment programs are not any more effective than short-term treatment program relative to recidivism. So you're offering 6 to 8 months worth of CD treatment, when wondering if that's been analyzed, at least the most recent research that's coming out. Similarly, I'm wondering if there's not a more low-cost sex offender treatment that can't be utilized in our facilities so that we can treat more offenders. I'm assuming you're using some kind of cognitive behavioral treatment approach with these offenders, and those kinds of programs don't have to be high cost. So what I'm searching for is, rather than saying, okay, let's invest millions of more dollars into treatment, let's see if we're doing that we're providing the most effective treatment, and B, whether we can get more people treated with fewer dollars. And I don't necessarily have the answer to that, and maybe you do, but I would like at some point an analysis of that.
Madam Chair and Representative Paymar, if you recall, the Legislative Auditor's Office did a study particularly of our treatment programs in prison. And one of the recommendations that they made in their report was that we move away from short-term treatment and go to a longer, more primary treatment. So we've done that. We also have moved to what we call mastery of programming, where, you know, you just it's not a certain amount of time, but it's once you're mastering the skills, so you've got to show competency in it. So the Legislative Auditor's Office kind of steered us away from that short-term programming. Now, that's not to say that there might not be a need for some short-term programming for, say, our release violators who come back to us. And we certainly have been thinking about doing that for a variety of reasons, including keeping our release violators busy. We've also been talking about the need for creating some programming for sex offenders who are lower risk, lower need, again, for that very reason. Maybe just some shorter-term programming might be helpful to reduce recidivism. So given that, do you want us to rethink the short-term programming again?
Well, I, Madam Chair, I would like to see the most recent, if you have the most recent research, because it's not saying that, so I don't know where the Legislative Auditor's report is, you know.
Deputy Commissioner Benson.
Madam Chair and members, I'm not a treatment professional, but certainly have been around this issue for a number of years. And I think the one observation that I would make is that our clientele is dramatically different from those that might attend a chemical dependency program in the community. We deal an awful lot with those criminogenic behaviors that are much more difficult than some of the community-based treatment programs might. In our experience, much more so than the Legislative Auditor's report, with all due respect to the Legislative Auditor, has driven us in this direction of more time in treatment for chemical-dependent individuals. And the other thing that I have said many times I don't think we've done a good job of is the aftercare. And we're trying now to set up better aftercare after people get out of treatment, because any self-respecting junkie can stay sober for 30 days or 60 days or 90 days. But learning to live a sober life in the community, I think, is much more challenging. So the notion of that strong aftercare, and again, I point to our CIP program, where we have a very regimented and strong aftercare component that requires the place to live, the job, the mentor, intensive supervised release, four face-to-face contacts a week. That recidivism statistic is more encouraging, too. We have some violations, but we aren't seeing new felonies. And it's, I think we're seeing more violations because we do a better job of intervening and supervising. So I would, again, we will look at the research, and we're doing our own research. In fact, we just completed a little piece of research on the short-term program that we used to offer and found that the legislative auditor was right, that it wasn't encouraging. That was more chemical dependency education than it was actual treatment. But you know, our best experience has been CIP. We're doing a longer follow-up of those that are being released from our other chemical dependency programs, and hopefully that data will be available at some point in the future here.
Thank you.
Other questions? All right. Then we have Assistant Commissioner Wes Koistra with the Department of Human Services, who had some questions he was going to answer for us.
Madam Chair, I've previously introduced myself. I would start with, in the same document, with question 7, that is, when will the sex offender program reach capacity at the new Moose Lake facility? We just had the groundbreaking at that facility today. And given the current rate of growth, assuming that we will be vacating St. Peter and the annex, which we believe we need to do because they are very expensive facilities to provide these services in, and we also have an interest in vacating St. Peter because we have our mentally ill and dangerous population there, and we don't think the policy of co-locating those services on the same campus is a good policy. So assuming that we vacate those programs, we will reach capacity at the new facility around the spring of 2010.
That's when it's done.
You got it. That's when it's done. So, you know, and folks, just so we understand, on the present trajectory that we're at, assuming nobody ever gets released, we will be building a sex offender treatment program facility or adding beds every 2 years. We will always have one of these in our bonding bill. So that's pretty, and not only will we have it in our darn bonding bill, we'll get it in my budget to pay for the beds. And that's pretty scary to me anyway, so continue.
Madam Chair, question 8 is, what is the breakdown of charges for those in the sex offender program that did not commit a crime as an adult? This was the question that was given to us by Senate staff and asked for charges. We don't have ready access to information on charges. We do have access to criminal databases that limited access, and we were finding when we were looking at charges that sometimes the charges didn't line up very logically with the conviction. So what we tried to do is get at what we think you were asking, and that is the background or the offense background of juveniles who did not commit crimes or were not convicted of crimes as adults. And we have about 40 of those individuals, 42 I believe last time I heard. And if you look at page 4, what we've done is gone into Westlaw for those district court commitment proceedings that were appealed or petitions that were appealed to the Court of Appeals. And we were able to to get some information on these juvenile offenders from that source, and this provides you some history on 10 of those patients.
And is this a random sample?
Yeah, it's the ones that were available on that. These were not selected by virtue of what the offense histories were or any of that criteria. It's basically going into that data source and seeing what was available to us. What I wanted to offer to this committee is that if this is it's fairly labor intensive to gather this information, but if this is information that's helpful to you, we will go ahead and pursue information on the remaining 30 or so individuals. But I just wanted, before we went too far in this process, I wanted to make sure that this was getting at what that question was.
Well, I think one of the things that's especially noticeable to me is the difference in the amount of time these various individuals have been in treatment prior to the time they were committed. If their conduct had been that heinous for that long a period of time, I find it difficult to understand why someone would only have been given 1 year of treatment as a juvenile or 2 years of treatment as a juvenile.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I'm not sure that I know the answer to that. It may be for some as simple as when the convictions or when the juvenile offense was discovered. For other, there may be other reasons as well, so I couldn't answer that question specifically. So if, Madam Chair,
this is one of the startling differences in these cases, yeah, that you've given to us.
Madam Chair, if this is then the kind of information, well, we can go ahead and do the work of pursuing that kind of information on the remaining juvenile patients. It just means we'll have to, we have the information, it's part of the records, it's not organized in a way that honors privacy and summarizes it in a way that's very helpful to the committee. So we will do that if that seems what you want.
Do people feel like it would be helpful? I guess so.
Question 9 was, from the clinician's perspective, what is the incentive for participation in treatment? I think that the context of this was the discussion about, at the current time, there's no one out on provisional discharge, or there's no one that has been discharged permanently from the sex offender treatment program. So I believe in the context of that, an individual committee asked, what is the incentive for participation in treatment if there have been no discharges? And I wanted to start with what we think are encouraging facts, and that is that treatment participation has increased from 55% to 90% for new admissions, and that we've seen an increase in treatment participation from 65% to 80% across all patients. So there's something there that is incenting patients to participate in treatment. We do know that there's a strong correlation between this increased participation in treatment and our efforts over the past couple of years to improve security and remove the criminal element from the therapeutic environment. We have, as was mentioned by Commissioner Benson, developed an Office of Special Investigation. They are there they've done important work in seeing, in discovering criminal activity within the program. They've acted on 4,000 reports the last year. 400 resulted in investigations, and we've returned about 94 of those investigated back to the corrections facility because either they have conducted serious violations of their supervised release from corrections, for those that are with us under supervised release, or they have been discovered to have committed another crime for which they were prosecuted. This is really important. It's not just a matter of removing people from an expensive treatment program. It's a matter of honoring a treatment in a therapeutic environment from which people who are serious about treatment where they can participate in it. And it's as important for the patients that there be security in that environment as it is for the employees or as it is for the general public. And the data that we've collected is fairly remarkable in the sense that I think there was something over a 0.9 correlation between this activity of removing the criminal element out of our environment and the increase in treatment participation. We've also made, I think, significant efforts over the last couple of years to improve treatment. We've really redesigned not only the security model in our program, but we've gone through a major redesign of our treatment program. So now we're providing treatment that's more individualized and focused on each patient's risk factor. We're emphasizing goals with more positive outcomes, in other words, what to become instead of what to avoid. This is all based upon the research and the literature. We've increased staff training and improved staff and patient interactions. We've increased patient activity. We've adopted quality of life enhancements for non-participants. In the past, the non-participants were just determined to not be cooperating with treatment and would be left alone. Now we're trying to approach treatment to people who are refusing treatment, and that may not serve a great purpose in the beginning, but it also involves people in treatment down the road sooner. We've changed our application of technology such as the polygraph based upon what literature tells us. We've separated patients based on cognitive functioning. We have special needs unit now, and we've separated patients, non-participants from participants, which has been also been important for those who have been actively engaged. And we've recently developed a community preparation services unit that really is a step-down option for people to leave the secure perimeter but remain on the campus with more privileges, and that unit just been put together. So we believe that we've improved the environment, the therapeutic environment, and that all the changes to our treatment program and our approach are delivering a message that we're serious about supporting the ultimate goal of patients to obtain reduction in custody. And I just have to go back. Those are all, that's conjecture in terms of relationship. I think we have harder numbers in terms of the activities of the Office of Special Investigation. But I think the most telling figures are the increases in treatment participation.
Are there questions?
Madam Chair, number 10 was how would have the released sex offenders in the 1997 study or booklet been dealt with in terms of civil commitment and sex offender treatment programs under today's guidelines, and how do the recidivism studies apply to patients in MSOP, in our sex offender program? Here I would point out, in terms of wondering how those who were released prior to the change in the Department of Corrections and state policy in terms of referrals of level 3 offenders, how they would have fared in recidivism rates or actually in commitment proceedings today, I would just point out that the statutory for civil commitment hasn't changed since 1994. Again, the most significant change has been the policy on DOC referrals to county attorneys for individuals that are recommended to be considered for civil commitment positions. That is based on statutory changes of 2005, but like it was in 1994, it is still the county attorney who makes the final determinations on whether or not to petition for commitment. That's always been the case. They've just been alerted to more cases since the change in law and the change in DOC policy. And it's still the courts that, of course, that determine whether the statutory criteria are met. And not all the DOC referrals result in petitions, not all petitions result in commitments, and we really have no way of hypothetically approaching that question. And I would say that we do not have any information that would suggest that the courts aren't applying the 1994 criteria correctly. And I raise that in that way because it really is the statute that drives the commitment proceedings. It's not referrals in that sense. In the end, it's the statute that is applied by the courts that results in the commitment of the patient to our program. With respect to the recidivism studies, such as the one that has recently suggested that there's a recidivism rate of 3%, these studies apply to a broader cohort of offenders, and only those offenders whose offense histories and characteristics allowed release to the community rather than civil commitment. The point I'm making here is that we serve in our treatment program only 2.5% of all registered offenders. And by definition of the commitment statute, those offenders are more likely to reoffend. The most recent recidivism study released, I believe, by Department of Corrections last spring states that those studied, patients most likely to reoffend are the following: those that show a pattern of sex offenses, those that show a pattern of juvenile offenses, those who victimized males under 13, those who victimized strangers, and those who have failed treatment. The factors leading to increased likelihood to reoffend are really the basis of the commitment criteria and really strongly represent the MSOP patient population. Again, I'm just saying that don't assume with recidivism studies that show 3% that you can apply that 3% to our population. That's the only point I'm trying to make. I'm not trying to make the point that recidivism isn't worthy of a discussion about the policy around commitment and discharge. I've just heard many people take the recidivism studies and logically apply the percentages in those studies to people who have been released to the community, to our population, and they just simply can't apply. A prior sex crime alone increases the risk of reoffense by 170%, according to that study. And I would also note that we have patients who have attempted to reoffend even while in our secure treatment setting, and it's also important to consider that recidivism rates are based upon known offenses that result in convictions. Many of our patients offended multiple times prior to their first conviction, and many patients have histories representing multiple sex offenses that have never resulted in charges or convictions. So at the risk of being redundant, again, I think recidivism discussion is an important discussion of the public policy around sex offender treatment and around commitment and release. But I wanted to alert people to be careful on how to apply the results of studies that have been released recently or prior.
Are there questions?
Chair.
Representative Paymar.
So I just want to be clear here. So this the risk of reoffense by 170%, is that for all sex offenders across the board, regardless of the sexual offense?
Or is that just for level 3 of sex offenders?
Madam Chair, what I can do is get you a copy of the DOC study, because that's where I brought this information from, reading that study and the qualifiers. My recollection of that, and I'm going to look at the DOC folks since I'm representing, is that it is all sex offenses. Is that correct? I'm getting a nod yes on that.
I would love to see that research. I mean, that just flies in the face of what we're being told. Eric Lippman has made a presentation to our committee that said something totally different.
Madam Chair, we'll make sure that the members have copies of that study. It's not correct for me to be representing it any more than the basic information that I'm providing. I wasn't an author of that study, and I don't want to misrepresent it.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there other questions? I guess my question is it something in our water? I mean, do we have that many worse people that are being committed than other states? Our law has been on the books one of the longest. We're now committing for the population of our size way more than most other states. We're committing close to almost as many as are being committed in California. And all of the other states that have a program as old as ours have released people successfully.
Madam Chair, I would like to comment on the looking at other states' release records, because I've read recently that you have to be cautious with that information as well. And that's what we're all struggling with, is how evasive the information, good information, is on this program across states. Because, for example, some of the releases that were reported in the New York Times article were not releases that were a result of successful treatment, but they were releases based upon legal technicalities.
And I'm going off of this.
And that's the report. That's where that information came from, was
okay.
That report. And I know that, for example, that California showing the whatever number released, I'm not sure what that document says, but I know that
59.
I know that the numbers that have truly been released as a result of successful completion of treatment would be much less than that. I also know that's true for Kansas.
Well, I'd take half.
based upon the documentary. And again, I'm not, we have not released anyone. And I'm not trying to skate around that issue. What I'm trying to say is that careful about the release data that you're seeing in some of those documents, because it's the best we have, but as we look behind some of these states, the stories get a little more complicated. I would also say that you had a testimony today from Senate staff or Senator House staff regarding how the commitment criteria works. Ms. White mentioned how the differences in commitment criteria from state to state. Our criteria is different than other states' criteria. We have different definitions from other states for commitment. We have an evidence standard that is clear and convincing evidence. Other states have an evidence standard that is beyond a reasonable doubt. Other states may have that stronger evidence standard, but a lesser criteria to be committed. We have a discharge standard that is slightly different than the commitment standard. And it really is, from my perspective, the biggest differences from state to state is what the law says.
Well, I believe we should be looking at those things, otherwise we wouldn't have had the research done. But, I raise a point about the water just because, you know, every time we get to this point of the discussion, we always are thrown this statistic. We only have 2.5% the total sex offender population in our facility. Well, obviously, there's no magic about 2.5% based on what we see in other states. Other states, many of them look like they have more like 1%. So that's the reason that I raised that point, because I don't know, you know, if we keep the way we're going, well, we will have more than 2.5% because we keep adding them up. But I do believe we need to look at the differences in the law to the extent we can, the differences in the treatment program, and the differences in the pool of people that are being committed, because there's a difference there, too.
Madam Chair, if I can say one more thing in terms of when you mentioned differences in the treatment program. I believe many of the changes that I cited to our treatment program were based upon bringing in national experts to our program and saying, how can we improve this? And we'd be happy to share that document with you that they did last fall, and they've just returned recently, and we can share the follow-up document with you. I have no idea what it's going to say about the progress that we've made. I think we've made a lot of progress, but that, from our perspective, that's our role. They're committed to us based upon legal criteria, and our responsibility at that point is to provide treatment. It's not our responsibility to determine what the criteria should be in terms of talking about Department of Human Services. It's our responsibility to try to provide the best, most effective treatment possible. And I want to deliver the message that we're relying on the most recent literature to drive that approach. But it's been a big change for us in terms of redesign of our treatment program security over the last 2 years. It's been a big change.
And I would imagine that there's a difference in the program that many of these states have for post-release than what we have, because I don't think we have one at all. And I think when the process that we have is being asked to look at whether someone is ready to be released, I believe to some extent that process would be influenced by what we're releasing someone to. So I think that's another thing that we probably would want to look at, is what are other states doing in terms of a post-release program. Any other questions?
Do we have more testimony, or is this it?
This is the end of our testimony okay. For today.
Well, I just have a comment. I was comment to the committee then, because I'm not sure how many men chair. I just would like us to entertain at least the thought of, since if I heard correctly, the sexual psychopathic personality is a legal definition and not a mental health definition. Well, if that's the case, then you know why doesn't this committee or the legislature think about enhancing prison time for the most violent sex offenders and keep them in our DOC prisons rather than in a mental health facility for 5, 6, 7 times the cost?
Well,
if it's a legal definition.
We actually thought of that, and that does remind me that I was going to ask about that, so maybe if Assistant Commissioner Benson doesn't mind returning to the table. We actually did do this. We changed the law, created an indeterminate sentencing arrangement where people would be evaluated in prison as to whether they met the definition of safe for release. And if they didn't, then they would stay there. But we were told at our last hearing that we are not sure the law is working. And do you have any more information on that? Apparently, there's only been a couple of people since the law was passed that have been convicted under that law, that they're plea bargained, or the courts give them, juries in this case, I guess it would be, give them other sentences, so that this solution that we thought we had, at least in the future sometime, for curbing the tide may not be the solution that we need, that it's not maybe working.
Madam Chair and members, I don't have any additional information beyond the fact that since the law went into effect, we've only received 2 sex offenders committed to the commissioner under the indeterminate sentencing option. And obviously, I think Ms. Gomez indicated that there's really been no research around what's driving that. Anything I would say would be speculative. But obviously, from a prosecutor or a judge's perspective, I think it's a tremendous bargaining chip in terms of plea bargaining. So that's what I would speculate. I believe that there are certainly more people that meet the criteria, but they aren't coming to prison, at least at this point. And I think I don't quite know how you'd get at that either, because you would be dealing with so many different jurisdictions. But it is unfortunate.
So I guess I would suggest that we at least spend a little more time thinking about and finding out more, as much more as we can, about this part of the dilemma we're facing as well. Other questions for today? If not, everyone, thank you very much.
Let me ask a 5 years ago, I drafted a